Well, enough of this interactivity. All right. You should have your Bibles open to 1 Corinthians chapter 14. 1 Corinthians chapter 14. The reason we're here is that we are looking at an issue that occurs in our epistles that points out this second measure of commitment that a son is to have to his sonship establishment and learning, which is his interactive learning, the interactivity of, as you're exhorted to do, crying after knowledge and lifting up your voice for understanding. Well, this issue of the two-way street is not a foreign concept at all in Scripture. In fact, it's what is actually taught. It's foreign to have just monologue going on where a teacher stands up and exhales for an hour or two and then sends everybody home and never has any area or any venue for them to be able to ask questions and answer back, or even just give comments to make sure that what they know gets confirmed. The Corinthians were having problems along these lines for various reasons, and within the context of everything that I set in the first session, we pick it up here with all of that kind of context that we were talking about in mind here. The Apostle Paul comes along in verse 26 and he says, "How is it then, brethren, when ye come together," and he's talking about them as a local assembly, "every one of you hath a psalm, hath a doctrine, hath a tongue, hath a revelation, hath an interpretation. Let all things be done unto edifying." Now, this is really the concluding matter to all that Paul has been dealing with from, actually, I know this goes back really to chapter 11, but especially from chapter 12 up to this point. And that's that major section where he's dealt with tongues and a lot of the spiritual gifts and those various things. As we said before, when you've got, you know, huge amounts of the curriculum that haven't even been written yet, and you've only got a few books around, or you've only got one or two that form that curriculum, you're going to need something to be able to provide for the complement of the saints' education and edification to properly take place in lieu of them having the whole curriculum. And we're in a much more advantageous and better position today having the whole curriculum. That's why we said last lesson, that it is a more excellent way once that which is perfect has come and those that things that are in part have been done away, once the Bible's been completed. And my understanding is the specific aspect of the Bible that was completed, that formed its completeness, was the writings of Paul, not John. Everybody says that John's revelation was the final book of the Bible. I'm persuaded that's really not the case. That's actually, the Bible never says that. That was said in a little blurb in an extra biblical account. But according as Paul's journeys have been logged throughout the book of Acts, I think it's apparent not only by that, but the very flat-out statement he says, that he fills up the words of God. And his words were what was going to complete the entire thing. Well, anyway, whether you're persuaded of that or not, I don't know if that matters that much, but my understanding is that Paul is concluding what he has been dealing with in chapter 12 up to this point. I tried to give us a little bit of steam to kind of get that locomotive moving a little in that direction, but all I'm after is not to get a comprehensive understanding of all of these things. What I'm after right now is to pick out of this the issues that pertain to us looking and saying, look, this is an assembly where the apostle, not just the pastor teacher of that assembly, but the apostle of all of the all of the dispensation of grace assemblies, that apostle was standing up there and he wasn't saying, hey, when you come together, shut up. And when you come together, don't say anything. And when you come together, don't talk to me and don't ask me questions. On the contrary, they were having problems. It was getting out of hand and it wasn't being done decently. It wasn't being done unto edifying. But he's going to correct all that. And in the correcting that he does, he doesn't take it away from them. He actually sets it aright. But he also verifies, validates, and make sure that this two-way interactive communication and two-way interactive learning is maintained properly and takes place properly. And that's one of the grand issues of having a local assembly, because God's built into the curriculum certain things that are only going to occur in proper edifying within that interactive learning of the assembly taking place. And all I'm after right now is the issue of Paul telling these saints in Corinth, and by application us, by application any local church, that when they do come together, there is going to be this expectation that there's going to be an interaction taking place, and how many times you hear it in this passage, with all the saints. And the idea is that it's not supposed to be just the bishop or the pastor in the pulpit doing the teaching, and that it's just supposed to be strictly monologue with no talking, no speaking ever on the part of the assembly at all. But the issue is that there is the expectation, and there's an actual provision here made for the opportunity for all the saints in that assembly to have active participation. If they want to engage in it, they can. If they're too timid, well, there's other ways that we can, that slack will be taken up. I'm not trying to put the finger on you and force you to do something that you're just too shy to do. But right now, I'm just wanting you to be aware of it more than anything else, rather than us actually doing it to the nth degree and the well-oiled machine that I expect us to be by the time we hit Romans 12 and 13 and 14 and 15 and those, the doctrine contained in there that brings us together and starts us down the road of being a local assembly that's knit together, that's got joints to it, and it's fitly compacted together, and it's functioning as it should be together. All of that will begin really forming in earnest in us in those chapters of Romans. So that the edifying here is going to be far greater than what it is today. And I think you've got that to look forward to. That's why I said you start appreciating the back of the head of the person that you're looking at in Bible class. And you start realizing, I am so grateful that person's here. And that's the way we should start viewing one another. And that starts out understanding what godly love and charity really is all about as we start functioning together as a local assembly, striving together and being members one another in the operations of God. I start looking at you and say, you're going to be in a particular operation of God that's vital to not only this assembly, but to you, to the whole vocation of the body in the future. You're very important to that. And the fewer of us there is, the more important you really are, you know, type thing. But it's not only Do you have verified here in this section the opportunity, the expectation for saints to take active participation in the assembly? And that's not only so that just interactive learning can take place, but even before you get to this point, you've already encountered, by the time you get to Romans, especially Romans 14 and following, there's this very important aspect of a properly functioning local church that there's supposed to be going on and ongoing in that local assembly, this mutual edifying of the saints. That is one of the operations of God, that there is mutual edifying going on, the edifying one of another. And you need to understand and appreciate that by your interactive learning in the local assembly, crying after the knowledge and lifting up your voice for the understanding, the truth of the matter is, you're helping out far more than just yourself when you do that. When we have a question and answer session and you lift your voice up, or we get together, even sometimes out in the parking lot, when you're able to make a comment and say something in the earshot of other saints in the assembly, you realize as an operation of God, you're helping someone else out oftentimes by saying that. Because your question or comment, you know, may very well be mutually edifying in some other member of the assembly who is too timid and too shy and too reserved to ask questions or raise their hand or make a comment out loud, and you say something and they say, "Now that's my understanding. I'm going to look and see if he verifies that." Or you ask a question, they say, that's exactly the question I would have liked to ask. I'm just too shy to ask it. That takes that slack up. And that question or that comment that you would like to make, but you're too timid to make, may also be one that someone else would like to ask or make, but they won't because of being timid about it. And that's why Paul says, how is it then, brethren, when ye come together, every one of you? Man, this was going on in spades. And the fact that going on in spades is what should be happening here and will happen eventually. I don't expect it to be overnight. It's going to take time. Some of you have no problem with it. In the question and answer sessions where you speak right up, you'll ask a question, you're not intimidated by me. You know I'm just another average person and you're smarter than me anyway. So what's to be intimidated about? So the whole issue is that every one of you has something you want to say. And that's what was going on. And the real beginning of how is it every one of you has something to say, the beginning of that was all this interactive learning that was going on. And when that assembly at Corinth came together, every one of them, as he says there in verse 26, hath a psalm. We were just talking at the break about many of the hymns and things like that. But they have a psalm. They have a song. Hath a doctrine. Hath a tongue, and that's part of the stopgap. Not only that was actually, like I said, in the interim, in the dispensational change that was brought in, that spiritual gift had an application to those who were still the members of the remnant of Israel, and God wanted to impress upon them the fact that I am now changing from your program, and I'm going to start working with these Gentiles. And one of the things that they were to understand and appreciate when they're, if you took this dispensation of grace out of here, and you were to see some of the things in their climactic stage, if there was no dispensation of grace up here at all, there was at a point in the climactic stage of their program that Isaiah talks about the tongues being spoken. That's setting back in Isaiah. That's setting back in the prophets. And it was to be done as a judgment upon Israel, upon unbelieving apostate Israel and their vain religious system, so that they realize the day of the Lord's wrath is at hand. It's here, and we're worthy now to have this come on us when they start hearing those things. And then what happened? They suddenly saw these Gentiles getting those things. And they realized, this isn't where we are then. God has interrupted all of this. And He is suspending His program with us. Now, I'm not saying that the Isaiah passage was to alert them that their program is being suspended. It was not. It was to alert them of the fact that they were now in the stage in which God's wrath was going to begin coming upon them. But He got their attention by giving some of that to the Gentiles so that the Jews could say, hey, wait a minute. This is supposed to be working with us. And He's not working with us. He's shifted His program here. And we are in trouble. But anyway, that's, again, that's getting me down. Like I said, this thing is fraught with me with problems of going down and chasing rabbits down and not getting to the point of what I'm after here. What I am after, though, is that every one of you has something you want to say. And he says, every one of them hath a psalm, hath a doctrine, hath a tongue, hath a revelation. Now that is one thing that I want to really look at. Because that revelation is going to, when a revelation comes out of the mouth, the Bible looks at that and calls that prophecy. And we're going to see something about these prophets and the prophesying that was being done at this time. And I want to mention that. That's one thing I do want to focus on for a moment. But we'll get to that in just a second. In other words, as you read down, he says, and then at the end of verse 26, what I'm after is the last expression of verse 26, let all things be done unto edifying. Whatever is being done here and all this interactivity going on in your assembly, it's not being done properly, and it's not being done properly unto edifying. That's what it's supposed to be doing. If it's not mutually edifying one another, if it's not producing proper godly edification, then it's got problems that have to be addressed and have to be dealt with. And that's what he's doing throughout this thing. And so he's underscoring how it's to be done unto edifying. In other words, everything that takes place and the order in which these things are to be done and be done, as he says, as he ends the chapter decently and in order, all that is to be accomplished by what each saint has to say when he cries after not and lifts his voice up for understanding. All that was being done and was to be done unto edifying. And as it's done unto edifying, it's the edifying that governs everything else. And that's really how one of the things a pastor of a local assembly, the bishop of the assembly, has to be very aware of, is that the assembly doesn't start going down avenues and start introducing things, even if it does come from the adult sons and the membership that want to do something. They may want to sing or they may want to provide something, that it's done unto edifying. Because that's the governing issue of everything that gets done in that local assembly. That it's to be done unto edifying. Let all things be done unto edifying. That governs everything. And the proper edifying of the saints, that's the goal of an assembly in the first place. The very purpose for it being the pillar and ground of the truth of local church, the driving core and goal of that assembly is for everybody. It's not to go out and make sure that the poor in your community are well taken care of at Christmas time. That's a nice thing. But it's a private issue with you through various charities or doing it yourself. Nothing wrong with that. But there is no mandate. There is no provision. There isn't even the place where this gets addressed as it being something that is a part of the proper function of a local assembly. It's a residual function of members within that assembly going out and providing in their communities and things like that. But the whole idea that most people have, certainly the media has, for the church, is that the church is FEMA. It's to provide disaster relief, and it's to provide poor relief, and it's to provide Cub Scouts and Boy Scout relief, and or being able to meet, and all kinds of things. When the driving force of every local assembly for every believer that goes there is to be edified, to get that sonship curriculum and that sonship edification. Because the truth of the matter is, nothing can take place that's worthwhile in connection with any of the operations of God within the local assembly unless it's coming out of and is produced by and is the fruit of sonship education. And it's unacceptable in any other way. And that's exactly what one of the big problems that was going on in Corinth was. That was not being done unto edifying. And I don't have the details. I mean, I can speculate because I see what happens oftentimes in some places. I can speculate, but speculation isn't going to edify. But the truth of the matter is, they're coming together with the doctrine, the tongue. Notice they even had doctrine. It's possible to be talking doctrine that has no edifying in it whatsoever. It's Bible doctrine. But it's not edifying. That's a shocker. You don't hear that too much in doctrinal circles. But Paul goes on through this passage, and as he does it, he deals with those who are speaking, who are they are lifting up their voice, who have a tongue, who are prophesying, and how they are to properly function and fit into all of this. Well, let's skip on down for time's sake here to verse 29. And what I'm really after is sitting in these verses. And I want to look especially at this issue of verse 29, let the prophets speak, two or three, and let the other judge. If anything be revealed to another that sitteth by, let the first hold his peace, for ye may all prophesy one by one, that all may learn and all may be comforted. Those three verses, 29, 30, and 31, are the verses I'm really after that spotlight how this interactivity is to be going on, this interactive learning issue. Now, I want to say something at the outset before I go any farther in this. about this issue of prophet and prophesying as it occurs here in Corinthians and especially within Paul's letters. And there's someone who used to attend here who was very critical of me when I taught this, but in all of the years since then, and I've looked at it, I not only believe firmly what I taught was right, but I'm more than ever convinced and settled in my own thinking that this is right. But you may have to settle this for yourself. When Paul talks about the prophets and the prophecy that's going on here, he's not talking about any of these guys here. He's not talking about Old Testament prophets. He's talking about prophets that function within this dispensation of grace. The problem that most folks have is the daggone word prophet. They just have a problem with the word prophet. Because to them, most people, when they get, there's a real burr in their inner man that causes a snag to occur. I know it does. It even sticks. You ever the expression, it sticks in your craw? It almost sticks in your craw to use this word because of how narrow the focus has become on that word prophet and how abused it has become, where every kook who wants to stand up in a service and say, God told me that you should not be wearing that blue sweater. God told me that you should not be wearing red. And God told me that I'll point to somebody, you should lose weight, or you should gain weight, or you should not stop dyeing your hair. God told me that your blondness comes out of a bottle. God told me, and you start getting wacko screwball stuff like crazy flipping around and all this kind of, and it's so distasteful and it's so despicable and so easily faked, and the fakery of it has been such that we just don't even like to use the word prophet or prophecy today. Now, there's that aspect to it, and I could draw that out a lot more and have fun with it, but a lot of folks get hung up and snags occur in their thinking about the word prophet or prophecy for another reason, especially those who rightly divide the word of truth and whose understanding, of course, of prophets only function out here and actually function both in the office and in the gift of the prophet and everything in Israel's program in time past. But it's very clear with what Paul says both here and in many other places, there were prophets functioning within this dispensation of grace. They were, pardon the expression, New Testament, church age, I hate that expression, but I'm going to use it, dispensation of grace functioning prophets. But the problem is that we can only seem today to, again, that word that you're looking at in verse 29 of 1 Corinthians, let the prophets speak, not only is it proper, it's the proper translation of the Greek, but it's also to be understood that this was written at the time in which our English language was formulated to be ripe for translation, in which English words were not narrowed down to standardized one definition type concepts, but that could be utilized in more ways. And the other problem, other than just the sticking in the craw issue of the prophet and prophecy, is that the most common way, if you go to a good dictionary, like the Oxford English Dictionary, which is, I don't think there is any other dictionary any better than that, the OED. I don't know if you can afford one. I certainly never could. I don't have the whole 22 volumes. Love to have them, but I can't afford them. But I could get the computerized version, and you've got it all on there, and it's a great program. And in fact, many times you'll type in a word and you'll be looking for it and it'll give you examples of how it's used. And lo and behold, you'll come along and it'll say Bible 1611. And it's the King James Version. It'll give the word right in there and use that as the defining issue of it. And so it's an enormous help and one of my best well-used tools in my toolbox in my studies. But what I'm after is if you go to something like the OED, and you look at prophet or prophecy, even there, the most common way we think of a prophet or prophecy is that a prophet And it's, to me, it makes it the most common definition of the term. What does a prophet do? When you think of a prophet, what's he doing? Exactly. And that's the most common way we think about a prophet. That a prophet and his prophecy is foretelling of future events. You know, Nostradamus is supposed to have been this great prophet. And I think the most prolific in my lifetime prophetical heightened interest that we've had, and each generation goes through one. My dad went through one. But to me, it was the rollover of the century. When we were going from 1999 to 2000, the whole world was buying, billions of dollars were spent on any kook who could write anything about prophecy. And, you know, the world's coming, there's going to be another bulge in that coming up in the year 2012, and that's got to do with a lot of alignment of stars and a lot of writings that have come down the line. I think even Nostradamus is supposed to have something. You know, we're all going to die and the world's going to end in 2012. You know, and people are saying the rapture is going to take place in 2012. I don't know. I hope it takes place in the next 5 minutes, then I won't have to be responsible for screwing any of this up. But that never seems to happen with me. You know, it's always one of those fleeting thoughts before every Bible class. You think I'm getting up from my seat to come up here, and the time I get from here to here, I've had this little prayer, oh, please let the rapture take place. Never does. But the issue, that's the most common way people think about prophecy and a prophet, is that it's the foretelling of future events. The utterance of predictions. It's making predictions. And they even call a weatherman a prophet. And he's horrible at it. They're all horrible at it. It's interesting, they can't tell me what's going to happen 24 hours from now and are usually proved wrong. And then they're wanting me to turn around and believe what's going to happen 50 years from now with global warming. Well, come back and let me know what, you know, when you can really accurately tell me what's going to happen 2 days from now, then I'll start listening to you. But until then, shut up. But the issue of uttering predictions, making a future event, foretelling, or even one who speaks by divine inspiration is often, you know, Isaiah and Ezekiel and Daniel and all of those guys were speaking by divine inspiration. My pastor used to use the expression, though, that you can not only foretell something, but you can also be a prophet and forth-tell it. You can tell it forth. It may be new information to the hearer, but as you tell it forth, you're speaking that as a prophecy. Because here's the thing, if you go to the OED, you'll find this is true. I didn't make this up. If you look down to the very next level of definitions for the word prophecy, if you pay attention to the context of a particular given area, and that the word prophet and prophecy can and is utilized in more than one way, in different ways, and as you look through a good dictionary like the OED and then start realizing, I grant you there's not 20 different ways, there's a limited number, but the very next way in which prophet and prophecy is the next most common use of the word, and this is what it says, the word could be used in reference to one who interprets or expounds Scripture. One who interprets or expounds the Scripture. And here's what's really interesting. The OED goes on to say, one who utters divine mysteries. He's uttering, he's lifting up his voice. He's uttering divine mysteries, and this is, I didn't write this, this is in the OED and you can go check it out. Utters divine mysteries and edifying communications. Yeah. You can function as a prophet by uttering divine mysteries and edifying communications. And that's exactly how these prophets function within this dispensation of grace. They weren't foretelling future events like these prophets did. They were forthtelling mysteries of Scripture that came to and through the Apostle Paul and his pen. And as they would go to these assemblies and begin expounding those things, those people were actually functioning as, and when, not only as in this dispensation of grace, local assembly, prophet aspect, but when they would even tell one another, hey, just heard this from the Apostle Paul. Listen to this. And then as they expounded that to the mutually edifying of one another, the Bible looks at that as forthtelling of prophecy. Because it was information that was, until Paul, not previously known. And the prophet was one who would communicate the doctrine and the curriculum that was designed for godly edifying of a member of the church, a body of Christ. The apostles, other than the Apostle Paul, were the men who were in charge of copying it out and sending it out. And they were doing the apostolos. They were sending it out along with the chief. Paul says, of whom I am chief. That's not I am the chief sinner. He is the chief apostle. That's a total misunderstanding of that passage. But he's got men who are copyists, who are writing and circulating them. Those are the apostles. The prophets are functioning as the bishops, the teachers, the pastors, and then as the mutual edifying of the saints was taking place. That's what this issue is. And I just think it's interesting, at least, and it shouldn't be shocking, but I just can't. I couldn't hardly read it and sit there and not just grin and slap my leg about it. That even the OED says that a prophet is one who interprets or expounds Scripture, utters divine mysteries, and edifying communications. And by the way, that's especially true and was utilized that way in the 17th century when the Authorized Version was written. And what until we continue to degenerate and de-evolve and dumb down the English language to where we just can't think of prophet or prophecy outside of, I don't know, Isaiah, Joel, or Malachi, and that it's foretelling of future events. This is a contextually sensitive term. Well, anyway, with that kind of understanding, you've got the issue of the prophet being brought up here. And because here in verse 29, let the prophet speak two, I'm never going to get through this, or three, and let the other judge. But because the issue is dealing with their particular job, it's bringing that to the surface, it's naming it, the prophets, and the gift that they had to, and there was a gift associated with this at the beginning of this dispensation of grace. That's why we don't talk about it today, because really the gift of that is gone, and really the office they held is not really an available office. It's only utilized in the sense of you know the communication of the information, but even that information is 2,000 years old now. But anyway, what I'm after is that the issue is bringing out what their job was, the gift that they had to do at this time in connection with the revelations that were still being given to and through the Apostle Paul in that local assembly. The ones who were prophesying were the ones who were the primary means for dispensing the curriculum. They were doing that job. That's what that gift was for, and what that job and that operation of God was for, the dispensing of the curriculum, and for the maintaining of and orderly presentation of and the going through of the curriculum. And Paul deals with them when he says, let the prophets, those guys in your assembly who are going to dispense the curriculum and do it orderly and go through it, let the prophets speak two or three, and let the other judge. If anything be revealed to another that sitteth by, let the first hold his peace. In other words, don't interrupt during the teaching session. For ye may all prophesy one by one. There's an order to it. That all may learn, and all, there's the mutual edifying going on from interactive learning, that all may learn and all may be comforted. And it's verse 31 that I'm primarily after here. He says, again, for ye may all prophesy one by one. All may be cut. Notice you switch from the prophets who are two or three at the most in verse 29 and how they're to function in their position as prophets on the basis of their gift and the receiving of the revelation and so forth as 29 and 30 describe. But notice when you get to verse 31, you're not any longer talking about two or three. In verse 31, I've tried to emphasize it by inflecting my voice each time. You switch to all, that ye may all prophesy one by one, that all may learn and all may be comforted. Verses 29 and 30 only deal with the prophets, and two or three of them at most. But verse 31 goes on to deal with all the saints in that local assembly that are going to be listening to all that information and hearing that information that comes through those prophets. And what I'm particularly after right now is that the reason why it says what it says here is because there's actively going on, and there had been going on for some time now, that very issue we've been looking at, interactive learning. That's what's been going on this whole time. I think I just went to the wrong one, but that's what's been going on, interactive learning. And when they came together and functioned as an assembly, and as he says later on, as he describes what assembly should be, the pillar and ground of the truth, and the teaching session was given the original and proper prominence that it was supposed to have, and that's something that's not done in almost every church today. The teaching of the Word of God is actually relegated to a secondary issue. Most of the people who go to a mega church don't go there to hear the Bible. They go there for all the other things. I mean, the vast majority of those people are going there for entertainment more than anything else. The light show, the stage show, the drama show, the choir show, the prop show, the testimony show, the wail and cry show, the praise and worship show. I mean, it's all a show. It's just unbelievable. And then there's somewhere in there where they actually take a Bible and maybe hold it up and read a passage and then horribly take it out of its context and then talk about what the pastor wanted to talk about anyway because he read a Hallmark card and got inspired by something or I don't know, saw something on YouTube and just couldn't stand to not tell you about it. But whatever it is, you know, and I saw one guy recently, he was teaching tithing, but he wanted to do it in a way because he believes, of course, he doesn't say this, that his people are so absolutely stupid and gullible they'll swallow anything. So he instead of using money, he was using fruit, like watermelons or something. And he had them all stacked up on the stage, and he took a tenth of them, you know. How dumb do you think people are? It's still the law, and you are still a messenger of Satan because you are teaching doctrines of devils. That's what teaching the Bible can be when you teach the law under grace. So congratulations, but you look good doing it. Kudos to your props, your prop man, stage crew. It's unbelievable. So that I just pause there with that caveat because when you come together as the pillar and ground of truth and the teaching session is the preeminent thing there and it's given the prominence it's supposed to have and the ones who are entrusted with that teaching, the prophets being focused on here, but then also it would become the teachers and the pastors who would follow after all of this when they did their job and the information was conveyed. And the teaching of that information was put out there so the saints could learn from it. Well, after all that took place, there was this natural forum or venue where this orderly time was in the assembly following that to ensure the learning did take place. It was to be done orderly. The Corinthians had a passion for doing things out of order. They just were scatterbrain in some ways, but what I'm saying is there's a natural time, and there was in this assembly, for once the accomplishment of the honest attendance had done its job, once that was done and had been successfully employed and engaged in, then there was this natural opening that took place for a time of the saints to engage in their interactive learning, and any dissatisfaction or discontentment that they had because they just didn't grasp everything properly or understand everything properly was able to be smoothed out and dealt with and get settled. So when the whole thing was over and they dismissed They could walk out of the session knowing what they had learned, knowing how to apply and use what they had learned. And what a great way to look at the end of verse 31. And all may be comforted. And they would walk out comforted. That doesn't mean that you just curled up with a nice blanket and a bowl of chicken noodle soup type comfort. This is comfort in the inner man. Satisfaction and comfort. And while there are many ways you can take comfort, and it can be used in a lot of different contexts, a particular way these saints could be comforted was all of that was by the dissipation of all that dissatisfaction. The interactive learning provided so that just went away. I was able to lift up my voice. I was heard. I made a comment. It was verified and confirmed. Or I cried after the knowledge. I had a question that I wanted addressed. And it was addressed at least to my satisfaction right now. And the dissatisfaction was dissipated. And what filled that void is comfort. And the truth is, if your honest attendance is what it ought to be, and if you're crying after knowledge and lifting up your voice for understanding by means of your interactive learning, the truth of the matter is, by doing that, you by virtue of that, need some comfort. You want someone to come along, and just as the word comfort means, comfort, you want someone to fortify or strengthen your understanding, and then with the C-O-M, the com is that Latin expression, puts it together, you want them to put it together with you so that the dissatisfaction, the discontentment just goes away and you get rid of it, and you are comforted. Comfort is a mutual issue. There's more than one party involved, you and someone else. And you come together and you are strengthened and fortified. Actually there's three factors involved in this in verse 31 for the accomplishment of this. And in fact, I think I'll just quickly run through this and we'll quit. And I've got a place coming up here where I can get myself stopped. This is a good way to put it. But there's actually three factors involved. And look at verse 31 again for the accomplishment of it. For ye may all prophesy one by one. That's what Paul was talking about back in the first part of chapter 14. We didn't go over all that. But it's not the issue of the prophets functioning with their gift of prophecy. It's the issue of them taking information that's been dispensed to them, and then they dispense it to others. They talk about it and go over it amongst themselves and doing it on the basis of this interactive learning issue. And notice that Paul says they do it one by one. They don't do that in some, well, I don't know if you'll get this or not, but they don't do it in some kind of committee behind closed doors in some kind of a conference. Not a conference that confirms what you should believe and what you shouldn't. It's the mutual edifying process of interactive learning, honest attendance, and the whole sonship curriculum. And ultimately, the being led by the Spirit through that curriculum. Not by you not having a voice and the powers that be going and closing themselves up to determine. And for those of you who probably is going over your head, but a lot of what many denominations believe were the result of what came out of councils or conferences. No, they do it one by one because the one whose attention is sought after and who's being addressed by them is the pastor primarily. And like I said, it's got those three aspects. All may prophesy one by one, that all may learn and all may be comforted. But in each one of those three sets, those three issues, it's always all. Not just monologue, this thing is dialogue. The point is here that for those saints who haven't had the information snap or click in their thinking are to engage one by one. That's orderly. They do that by lifting up their voice. They get their questions heard, asked, and addressed. So the next issue in verse 31 happens, so that all may learn. Yeah, the reason our question and answer sessions are so profitable is because all may learn through some of that. It's not the only means by which learning occurs in the local assembly, but it's a vital means. It's God, in fact, has designed some things to only be able to occur and click when that kind of interaction takes place. And so they do this so that all may learn. And the end result of all that is so that they do learn, they can understand the information, they know what they're being taught and know how to use it, and then they can all be comforted, is the third measure. They can leave the session with comfort in their inner man about fully grasping all the information covered in that class. Now, you may have questions about other things, but as far as what was covered in that class, I got it. And sometimes some of you will just give me that. And I love that. Nothing more than that. I got it. Okay. That's all I needed to hear. And that's wonderful. But that's the powerful... That is... Do you begin to realize, does it start cracking and dawning upon you of the powerful function of a properly working local church? Man, I mean, that's one of the reasons why early... You know, 200 years ago, they looked at the local church not only as the place where doctrine was taught and edifying took place, but every other matter that dealt with judgment was to be brought in there. That's why they'd hold court in churches. Because the people who had the best decision-making skills were supposed to be believers who were properly educated as sons. They can make decisions on the scale that the Supreme Court could never make, and actually can't make. Can be made in the local assembly. The power that God has vested and the function that God has vested and it doesn't have to, it can be just this size. But it's a functioning local assembly. It's got a supported pastor teacher. It's got a deacon or deacons, and I've had one deacon before. But it's got the structure to it, and it's got godly edifying taking place because it's got honest Bible handling, honest attendance, interactive learning, and then the third thing that we'll start dealing with maybe next time, but the powerful working of that local assembly, and that's what a properly working local church should have as part of it. And that's really how it's the other side of the coin, so to speak, the teaching of the pastor being the one side of it. That's really how godly edifying is supposed to take place biblically, where the pastor teaches uninterruptedly, orderly, with good manners to boot, and then he will provide for a proper time, usually at the end of the session, for any kind of lingering questions or comments to be made. And maybe in his judgment, the best thing is to go 2 or 3 weeks. And then after because he knows he's got to cover a lot of things that will answer the questions, but once he's covered a particular segment, he provides that on a periodic basis so that you have the avenue and you know it's coming up. And that's the way godly edifying has been supposed to have been done all along biblically in this dispensation. Well, there's some other wonderful things we'll look at here. I just want to briefly look at it before we go on to this third measure. But I think this is a really good place to stop. So we'll stop right now and we'll actually pick it up with one other little area or maybe two, but that I just want to underscore because this is so foreign to us. I just want you to see there's a lot of places in Paul's letters we could go to and find this happening. Not just this one. There's a bunch of them. And I want to at least bring a couple others to your attention before we get done. I won't go into them in nearly as much detail as this one, but just bring them to your attention and maybe you can have fun and enjoy discovering some on your own. But then we're going to move to the final area and there's some very compelling things about that. And we'll go back to seeking, if thou seekest her as silver and searchest for her as for hid treasures. Let's see what this money we can spend and what we can buy with this education's all about. So, all right, with our heads bowed, with